The opinions you love. The history you crave. This is Rant EM Radio.
The following is brought to you by the Shining Wizards Network, home to many great podcasts, including Turnbuckle Throwbacks, Two and a Half Wrestlers, Inconclusive Breakdown, Neckbreaker, Thursday Night Destruction, The Midnight Jury, After Midnight, and of course, The Shining Wizards. Available on iTunes, Stitcher, Audio Boom, and at ShiningWizardsNetwork.com.
What's up, guys? Big Phil here. And we hope that you had a wonderful and awesome Christmas. And we are about to end 2014. It was a monumental year for us, for the Rant, for the Shining Wizards Network. And we just, on behalf of the Mega Powers, I just want to thank each and every one of the shows, all of our peers, all the fans who participated in all of our madness. It's been a crazy, crazy year. We've had some ups, a little bit of downs, but, you know, you live and learn. Again, like I always mention, this is a labor of love, and we do this for ourselves and, more importantly, all of you. And we hope you enjoy the content each and every week that you're getting for free. So this is just a little best of I put together. Did a couple of interviews, a couple of segments. And like I mentioned at the last show, Dave and I are diligently working on next year's stuff already. And we hope you guys stick around, and we really hope that you enjoy tonight's episode and moving forward 2015, because it's the Turnbuckle Throwbacks, man. You know how we do. So, again, have a great New Year's. Have an awesome 2015. Stay blessed. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. And that's pretty much it. Enjoy this best of, and we'll be back in 2015. Peace.
So they can't get a jacket.
We gotta go there. That, we gotta go there,
dude.
I've been there.
I know.
I ain't gotta go nowhere. I've been there.
I told my wife, man. I said I would. If I, she's like, what would be your dream vacation? It's definitely not Hawaii. It's fucking 8 hours, fucking north.
Oh, more than that. Oh yeah.
It's eight hours north
of Hawaii.
That. It's fucking go to across the Pacific. I definitely want to go to Japan.
Yeah.
And I'll say on record that was the best steak I ever had in my life.
See, it's not just all bullshit.
So now Dave, you've been to the steakhouse. You can't get a jacket unless you're a wrestler. Is that the whole bag? Or
I purposely didn't get the jacket because I wanted to go back. Give myself some unfinished business.
There you go.
Some unfinished business, baby.
If you will. Some Heroes of Wrestling 2 type shit.
Right.
Yeah.
So these guys wanted
to go there and say I was part of Heroes of Wrestling. And...
Dude, so Abby's all busted up. They fight double count out. This is just a fucking garbage match.
Of course. There's no winners in this match. There's no winners in this event.
There's no winners at all.
Except
us.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we win. Cause we
well, this hope. Next match was kind of surprising. We talked about this on the car ride
yeah,
over.
Yeah, I'd say match of the night.
This was the match
okay,
of the night.
Okay, brother.
Match of the night.
So Snuka, the killer.
He's just standing there motionless.
Yeah.
The fucking cold-blooded killer, Jimmy Snuka. the former Jimmy Superfly Snuka.
By the way, shout out to the Mega Powers podcast. They sent us a tweet this morning that they loved the show, the last show, and hashtag Snuka did it.
Yeah. And
look
I'm glad that there's a podcast solely dedicated to me. So.
Yeah, solely dedicated to you. Those guys are awesome. Shout out to them in the Bloke Show, and I'll plug them in a little while. But
Snuka's eyes are just saying kill.
Yeah.
Yeah, look at that cold-blooded killer.
What was that
murder?
Her Friday 13? Kill. Snuka.
He's just thinking about going to some sort of like motel, and forcing some woman to squat on the side of the road and bash her head with a rock.
Dude, at Legends of the Ring, he was like the first one to come in. He walked right over to our table and shook our hand.
Yeah,
really.
And we shook that killer's hand.
I was like, Dave, we just shook Jimmy Snuka's hand. Like we were like fucking like two kids at an NSYNC concert.
Yeah,
this hand killed a woman.
Chop, 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 chop.
Fucking jumping off the dresser with a Superfly splash. Taking the Bible from the drawer and just bashing her over and over again.
terrible.
Oh, Bob Wharton.
Bob Wharton's a fucking.
He looks like, you know what he looks like? A dummy from a ventriloquist.
He looks like a Muppet.
Yeah, he does look like a Muppet.
That that fucking hair of his.
If Ralph was human, he'd be fucking.
Yes. Or like Fozzie there.
Fozzie. Waka waka.
Waka waka. I got hepatitis too. Waka waka waka.
And there's another great Rosenbloom quote.
Oh, what's the quote for this one?
He starts it off by saying, you know, this feud has been going on since 84. And then, like, literally a few seconds later, he says, we've been looking forward to this fight since the card fight. The dispute at the card table.
Oh, God. Yeah, so he's like,
are you fucking kidding
me? Back in 84. And then he's like, yeah, because of the cheating at the card table.
Yeah, right? We've been looking forward to this since, like, a half hour ago when we, you know, filmed these guys trying to cheat at cards.
Ridiculous. The match itself, though, was not bad.
No, they actually, like, wrestled. Like, whoa, suplex.
Yeah, a delayed suplex, too.
Delayed suplex. He was actually able to hold his old-ass body up in the air.
He looks like Willy Wonka.
Yeah.
Bob Orton kind of looks like Willy Wonka a little
like,
bit.
What, like Gene Wilder with tits?
Yes.
Is that it? Yeah, I could dig that.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And Snuka doesn't look...
He looks like a melted chocolate bar. So.
Yeah.
Okay, brother.
Snuka's not at his worst yet, but no. he was on his way at this point. This was
but
the decline.
He was able to move during
at least he doesn't look like Paul Mahoney, like a fucking melted candle.
Yeah.
Yeah, Snuka could still move in 1999. It was like only a couple years later. I think after his match with Jarrett on Nitro is when he started to really
My buddy Jay wrestled him a few years before this, like in 97 or 98, when Jay was wrestling for Johnny Rods in his school in Gleason's.
Oh, boy.
And he said Snuka was a chain smoker.
Oh, yeah?
Snuka would go outside, have like a fucking half a pack and come in.
Dude, whenever I had to go back to my car during Legends of the Ring, Snuka would be outside smoking.
Yeah.
And he would be in the same corner. And then
was
I would
he by
leave.
Himself?
He was by himself. And then like I would go back in for like a couple hours. And then like, oh, I need to get some from my car. And he'd be out there and still in the same corner smoking. So.
Okay, brother.
Was his ashtray a coconut?
No, it was... It was some girl's skull.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh my.
That's if you
when
wheel.
You're choking that sake, that's risky business, brother.
No offense to Dusty, but this is Hogan talk tonight.
Oh no, definitely. I definitely got a good Hogan moment back from I think it was 86, 87 at the Garden. It was a house show.
Right.
And he faced Kamala. He came out like I kind of ripped off Dusty Rhodes with the face paint when Dusty Rhodes came out with the face paint. I remember hearing one of your podcast shows when you were talking about when he fought Kabuki, and it was like, you know, some funny shit. Like he did like I believe it was like Apocalypse Now, or whatever. But Hogan came out with the Kamala face paint, or whatever. It was at the Garden. The whole place where it went crazy and. Hogan just like fucked up Kamala. I think it was like about like an 8 minute, like a 10 minute match or whatever, main event or whatever. And you know, of course, it was like one of the matches that Hogan went on like about like I think it was like six or it wasn't the main event. I remember the main event was, if I'm not mistaken, it was what
match.
Was that? Billy Jack Kane stepped in, I think, for Dynamite Kid for stepping in with Davey Boy Smith
against the Islanders. You're talking about?
Yeah. I was at that card.
No, it's like
you was at that card.
Yeah,
definitely.
Of course I was.
You probably was at that card. I know you probably was there. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
the place just went crazy when Hogan came out with the face paint like Kamala, or whatever, when the music hit on and whatever. And I remember he just ran in there, and that was like one of my favorite Hogan moments. Like that, I got to see Hogan live. That was like my first event that I got to see Hogan live. You know, like I've been to other shows, like whatever, when Backlund was on when I was real young, but like, you know, like I really don't have too much memory, whatever. But when wrestling really got off, it was definitely when Hulkamania got off.
So, wait, what did you know? Like as a kid at that time, what did you think was going on when Hogan was going to go against Kamala?
Oh my God, I was thinking to myself, can he just beat this guy? You know what I mean? Because I thought Kamala, like I remember seeing Kamala, like from, you know, from his, you know, from the Von Erich days when he was down at WCCW. And I'm thinking, this guy's, like, larger than life. And I'm thinking, like, Hogan can't just beat this guy. Can he beat him? You know, at the time, you know, you're young. I was a mark. Definitely a mark. I was 11 years old, I remember, at the time. And, like, Jesus, man. That place just went crazy when Hogan slammed him and just, like I said, came out with the face paint. I think I remember the Wizard was his manager. Hit him with that. I think he had, like a tooth or whatever that he came down to the ring with around his neck or whatever. Hit Kamala with it, whatever. And that place just went crazy, man, when Hogan kicked his ass, man.
And you touched upon something that I really want to bring up. It's like, you know, at that time, you know, you said you were Mark. This was like, you know, whether people knew wrestling was fake or not back then, like people's, you know, belief was like, you know, that suspension of disbelief. And for me as a kid, watching Hulk Hogan, like, it didn't matter who he was going against. I was like, he's going to lose.
Exactly. It was like fucking Superman.
I agree.
It was like seeing Superman, dude. It was like,
yeah.
Like
you didn't know what the hell was going to happen. You know, all these, they were bringing out fresh guys all the time. Like you mentioned on the one man gang.
Yeah, that was the NASCAR Coliseum. That was insane.
It's like one man gang is going to be the one that does it. And it's like, no.
But it went out
for years.
What was that, Tony?
Not to move ahead, but when they brought in Zeus and he did the thing on Hogan I really was hurt. I really was like, yo, how is he going to beat this guy?
Yeah, even Zeus. And when I was, you know, I remember going to see, I'm wearing my Rip'em shirt right now. funny story.
He's wearing a Rip shirt right now.
Yeah,
guys,
I'm wearing the Rip
speak.
Shirt, brother.
No joke.
And it's funny to bring this up because I remember going to the movie theater, wanting to go see that movie. Like, the movie just came out. My dad's like, you want to see the Indiana Jones movie instead, right? And I'm like, no, I want to see No Holds Barred.
You're crazy.
Remember they had a program to that? Didn't they have a program to that?
They had a pay-per-view. It was the match, and then they showed the movie on pay-per-view, and then they showed the match right after it, live, the cage match.
I remember that.
But I really want to put this over. It's like Hogan had this grip on humanity for a good decade more. It didn't matter what he did. Didn't matter who he was facing. It just, like, he was.
If they hurt him, you hurt. Like, if they hurt him, like, when Taker came in.
I'll say
and
this.
Try to put him in the coffin.
Oh, yeah. I'll say this.
Yo.
I have no shame in saying this. In 1994, because I was still young, when he was going against, you know, Ric Flair at WCW Bash at the Beach 94, I was besides myself. I was legitimately crying during this pay-per-view because I didn't know if Hulk Hogan was going to win.
You didn't know if he was going to win?
Yeah, I was crying legit.
I was pissed because I knew he was going to win.
Yeah.
Oh, Hulk
shit.
Right.
Guys, hold on a second. I'll take another call. Hold on 1 second.
Phil, didn't you think?
Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. What's your name? Where you from?
Right. I thought you guys were going to be talking about the 11th anniversary of the C Nation. What is this shit with Hulk Hogan? Come on, guys.
Motherfucker. Wait a minute. What's up, Tony?
Come on.
Shining Wiz is on the phone.
What's going on, fellas?
Not much,
up,
man. We got
Tony
like a fucking,
Z.
It's like a 90s party line over here.
Yeah.
We got like seven
this
guys
is the,
on the
this
phone.
This is the Hulk Hogan hotline right now. 1-900.
Should I ask
you guys? 9900.
Hey,
you know you guys are being charged $2.99 a minute for being on this podcast right now, do you?
All right. Let's clear up. George, any other favorite Hulk Hogan moments before I let you go, brother?
Hello?
Yeah, any more Hogan moments before I let you go?
Yeah, there was one more time. I don't know if you was probably there. It was probably like in the Garden in 91, December House Show, 28th. I remember he...
Wait, stop it right there. Was that the Hogan-Bossman cage match?
Yeah, I think it was 91. Hogan and Tugboat.
Oh, no, no, never mind.
Earthquake and Bravo.
No. Well, I was there for that, but I thought you meant the Saturday matinee when he superplexed...
Oh, no, definitely. I was there. You know, I was trying to call in for that show. I was there for that one when he super clicks Boss Man for the matinee.
I was there.
That was definitely his best shit at the Garden. So, I'll debate that with anybody.
So what was the match you were talking about? The one with Tugboat against who?
It was Tugboat and it was him and Tugboat against Bravo and Earthquake. And I remember I was there. I was close enough to get what Hogan was getting it on the outside from Earthquake, and I remember I managed to slap Hogan on the back. You know, you try to get there, you can touch the rest of us or whatever. It's shit. And I remember I slapped him.
Hello? Okay.
We lost
George, but thank you for calling there, Uptown.
Thanks,
all right there, Shining Wizards, what's going on?
Nothing. What point are you guys up to in the Hulkamania timeline? I think my stream was a little behind, and I wanted to turn down my radio.
We were like in 89.
We're jumping a little bit. We're heading to WrestleMania 2.
WrestleMania 2, what the world has come to?
Of course.
Susan St. James on the microphone is a win every time.
Yeah, you ain't lying. That whole car was awesome. Bulldogs with Ozzy in their corner.
The Battle Royal.
The Battle Royal with the football players. The
boxing match.
The boxing match was terrible. But Pipe was awesome.
Still, it was fun to watch that shit go down.
Yeah, of course it was. When you but
fucking blown
poor
up.
Poor Dynamite Kid takes a nasty headbutt, spills off the top rope to the arena floor, and we get a shot of Ozzy holding up the belt, going, Bulldogs forever!
Yeah, man.
Love
Ozzy. Anyway. The Hulkster had his montage before his match to music that went on to be the entrance music for Jake the Snake Roberts. And there's your trivia for the night, boys.
Look at that.
Yo, and actually for WrestleMania 2, the funniest moment was they were doing the national anthem. And you have, like, all these patriotic images, you know, like the flag, you know, the Lincoln Memorial. And then at the end, they have Hulk Hogan. And I actually, when the WrestleMania anthology came out, I was watching it with a friend of mine, and he fucking hates Hulk Hogan. And we were watching, you know, the national anthem being played. And, you know, at the very end, they show, like, this image of Hulk Hogan. And he was like, oh, you got to be kidding me. Are you fucking, what the fuck is this? And I'm like, ah. It was the most hilarious thing.
Yes, that was a great show.
But, I mean, Hogan had some great moments, man. I mean, the Bundy thing with Saturday Night's Main Event, that was fantastic. Oh, yeah.
Breaking the ribs.
Of course.
Hold on once.
Morocco held him down. It was beautiful. It was a great, it was an excellently executed plan by the Heenan family.
Hold on
1 second.
Bundy
in a cage match at WrestleMania 2.
Excellently
Turnbuckle
executed.
Throwbacks, what's your name? Where you from?
How you doing? This is Anthony Gargiulo from Well Premier Wrestling. How are you?
Anthony, hold on 1 second, brother.
Let's see. No problem.
All right, now I've got like crazy things calling in. All right. I got to hang up on that call. Whoever I just hung up on, I apologize. I got to take this call. Guys, hold on 1 second. We got to talk to Anthony from World Premier Wrestling. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
Good, man. We're doing a Hulk Hogan tribute tonight on the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. Well, those who don't know, my friend Anthony here is the COO of World Premier Wrestling. And, Anthony, tell us a little bit about what's going on at World Premier Wrestling right now.
All right. Well, World Premier Wrestling is back bigger than ever. We're actually going to be doing a major show at the Resorts World Casino in Queens, New York. We have... the whole third floor of the casino for our fans. We're going to be doing, we're going to be in a show about 60 wrestlers. We have Roddy Piper is going to be there, Jimmy Snuka, Matt Morgan, Crimson, Angelina Love. We got names from the old days, names from today. We're expecting to have around 6,000 people there, so we're going to do it for our fans. We're going to do it nice. And, you know, we want everybody to come down.
The World Resort Casino is the where Aqueduct used to be, the racetrack
over
there?
It's actually, they opened up a brand new casino there, and it's really, really nice. And, you know, in case you guys don't know where it is, you can, there's transportation from all over the city that's free to come to the show. There's these luxury charter buses that leave out of Midtown, Downtown, Brooklyn, Queens. Wherever you're from, you don't even need to come and park your car. You can take the bus. It's free.
All right. Hold on 1 second. Guys, whoever's trying to call in, stand by 1 second. We got to talk to Anthony for a few minutes. All right. So the show's going down March 8th in the World Resort Casino in beautiful South Queens, New York City. You're going to have a pre-show, actually. It's called the Holy Grail Fan Fest. Is that correct?
Yeah. That's if you're a fan of not only wrestling, if you're a fan of sports, this is one event you want to be at. We're going to have over 100 vendors that are bringing collectible items, special, exclusive stuff they're going to be selling. We're going to be having sessions where you can take photos and autographs with these wrestlers that are going to be at the show. What we're going to even do is we're going to have an opportunity for our fans to take a picture in Roddy Piper's pit.
That's fantastic.
And even if they want, they can take a picture in the ring with one of their favorite wrestlers. We're doing it for the fans. We want our fans to be happy. We want our fans to see what we're about. And, you know, it's not your local gym where you go and you sit on the folding chair where you have a couple hundred people. We're doing it with the most class to show our fans what we're about.
So you have the pre-show. It's the Fan Fest from 2 to 6. Showtime's at 7:30. Doors open at 6:45. Like Anthony said, they're going to have a fan fest, over 60 wrestlers, some pro athletes,
legends of the past, which, of course, we love, superstars of today. And where can they get tickets for this, sir?
All right. Well, you can go to our website, which is WPWWrestling.com, where you can select our ringside seats, which are around $50. You can select the general admission seats, which are $30. Now, if you buy a ticket to the show, you're going to get that pre-FanFest Holy Grail for free. Okay? Our VIP seats are already sold out. Our ringsides are going quick. Follow us on Facebook at World Premier Wrestling. Go on our Twitter page. You know, we're having a lot of big things happen that day. Extreme matches, table ladders and chair match, Rumble Royal. We have a couple of surprises for you, the fans, too. So, you know, we want everybody to come out to Queens March 8th from 2 to 6 p.m. to the Holy Grail. 7:30 is the main show. If you guys want to hang out after the show, we're having an after party. Hang out with the wrestlers, have a couple of drinks if you're over 18, 21. You know, and while you're there, you can gamble, too.
Yeah, if you're of age, of course. Dave likes to play the slots, right, Dave?
Something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. You could play the slots while you're watching the show.
So, yeah, again, go to WPWWrestling.com. All the information's there, like Anthony said. The show is Resurrection, Saturday, March the 8th, 2014, obviously, in the Resorts World Casino in South Queens, New York City. And, of course, we'll be promoting the show now from now on and hopefully some future shows. And Dave and I are going to hopefully we'll be there for the event because it's going to be happening. Independent wrestling, as you all know, has had a resurgence in the last couple of years. And this is nothing short of spectacular, it sounds like.
Yeah. It's going to be one to remember. You guys got to experience the difference in wrestling, the whole production of it. We're bringing in the big stars.
He still has an impact on them and how they operate and how they, you know, try to create their own style.
So we got about 4 minutes before he's supposed to be calling in, actually. The author lives on the West Coast, so which is why we're talking about Brody leading up to the interview. Is there anything else we should talk about the book specifically before we get into the interview that I think the fans might want, like our insight? Like, I already gave my insight about Nick Bockwinkel, but...
You know, all I can really say, because, you know, a lot of people were asking questions, and me and Emerson kind of little bit, you know, touched upon this before, and it's kind of like, oh, there's a lot of people that are brand new to Bruiser Brody, and they don't know, you know, a lot of stuff that we've been well versed in over the years. You know, there's even some of the listeners who's like, you know, I just heard about this guy, and I sent him a bunch of videos, and you know, this book just touches upon everything. It goes from the Luger cage shoot, which for me, you know, kind of like what you mentioned, you know, as far as the mystery or the, you know, the tall tales of Bruiser Brody, you know, that was always one of them, the Luger cage match. Because they had this cage match, and Brody, you know, just like a typical match, but then out of nowhere, Brody just, like, stopped selling for the guy. And we all know Luger's punches are, you know, they're, like, almost on par with the Sid punches. They don't look good.
Exactly.
At all.
Right.
So when you got a guy like Bruiser Brody just like not selling them, it's like, what the fuck's going on? And I've heard so many stories about this match and, you know, why Brody did it. I even heard stories about him putting razor blades inside of his tape on his fingers, and he just showed it to Luger, so Luger just bounced. You know, there's just so much, you know, fiction and so many different spins on Brody, which is also kind of, you know, why this book was put together. You know, there's some guys that knew him, like, so well, but their stories don't completely jive with everybody else's stories, you know?
All right. Well, before we get into the video, I'm going to play the promotional video for the book from BruiserBrody.com. So if you guys don't mind, I'll play that right now. Yeah.
Anywhere he went, around the world, Japan, Asia, all over, you know, Europe, South Africa, when he went down there, Anywhere you went, they knew the name Bruiser Brody.
They wanted to see violence, and we give them violence. I mean, if we had to take a bottle and break it over somebody's head or whatever, we'd done it. And we didn't care what we'd done.
Frank Kudisch was very private, very to himself, walked to his own drummer both in and out of the business, and didn't necessarily mingle. Frank was not one of the boys.
And he said what he thought, and he made a lot of enemies along the way. I mean, he had a lot of enemies in wrestling because he wanted to do things on his terms.
Brody was a good wrestler, but he was more or less my style. He'd pick up a chair, he'd pick up a club, he'd pick up whatever he could get his hands on, that's what Bruiser Brody done. See what I mean? And in the ring, he was a violent man. Outside the ring, he was a good man.
I don't know if both him and Stan, somebody said that one time the two of them agreed, try to screw over every promoter they could. Whether that's a true thing or not, but it just seemed like it.
He never went to any one territory. He'd go to all the territories, and just his style too. It's, you know, so many people that came after him took a piece of his style and molded it into their own style. So he's looked up upon by all the guys that I know.
You know, the 20th century, the greatest, you know, foreigner in the 20th century, and Brody got more of
it. It's calling in. It's all you.
Yeah. All right.
Good evening, Turnbuckle Throwbacks.
Hey, is this David?
Phil and Dave, how are you, sir?
Hey, great. How are you guys?
Doing awesome. How are you doing, Emerson?
Good. I just kicked my family out of the house, so.
Nice.
Other than the dog whining, we should be okay.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, we're recording right now.
Oh, okay.
So we'll just get right into it and, so you know, we were just talking about the book we're going over. We're actually just playing the promotional video off of YouTube, so everybody can.
Oh, yeah, it. Yeah. Did you guys just get a copy of the book?
I got my copy in December.
Yeah.
So this is brand new. I didn't know the book came out in 2007. But
yeah, it's been around for a while, so it was sort of surprising to get your call. Yeah. It was or your email, but it was interesting because. A Wrestling Hall of Fame asked me to write a bio like almost the exact same day. So I was like, are these connected? But I guess they're not.
No.
It was weird after all these years.
We're an old school wrestling podcast. And when I did like the first 20 episodes by myself. This is Phil, by the way.
Oh, hey.
And when Dave came on, Dave was is a huge fan of, as I am too, of Japanese wrestling and
uh-huh.
of the strong style and all of the gaijin that went there. And, of course, Bruiser Brody was one of my favorite wrestlers of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a teenager when he passed. And when Dave and I got together, we were swapping videos. And I said to him, I was like, we got to do a show on Brody. Not just
oh, cool.
one show, but a show. And I think... The one book that always came up in conversation was yours. And,
oh, good. Okay.
Well, because, I mean, when people talk about the legacy and the man that was, you know, there's so many different perspectives of him, you know? And, you know, the way you put the book, the way you have it situated is you just interviewed a bunch of people that were around – In that time, whether it was family and you know, coworkers and people he worked with and stuff like that, and then the way it's broken down, it put a whole new perspective on it for me, because there were certain things I didn't know about him. Like I didn't know he was a good writer. You know,
sports.
Yeah. For me too. I mean, you know, I came at it from the perspective of a fan, for sure, and. The real goal, well, first, you know, I wanted to do a film on him, a documentary, and I saved up a few $1,000s and sort of started down that road, and that's kind of what you're watching on YouTube, some footage from that. And that didn't pan out because I kind of jumped into it without really knowing much from the production end. I was mostly in the camera department and lighting, and... So that kind of fell apart, and after a while I thought, well, this just can't die. I have so much good stuff. You know, I had the Abdullah interview. I had the Dory Funk interview. Killer Kowalski. I had a bunch of people. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe this would make a good book. And one of my favorite old books was a documentary or a biography by a guy named Rudolph Gray about the filmmaker Ed Wood. And it was done all in quotes. And I thought, God, well, that, you know, I'm on my way already. I could continue this project and just call people on the phone and do it that way. So that's kind of what I did. The goal was really to make a textbook. I thought, you know, I want to cover this from all angles and have this be, you know, the final sort of word on Bruiser Brody. We'll have all the different angles. We'll cover everything, even the driest, smallest little, you know, 6 month title reign in a small territory, I'll at least mention. So we just get everything, you know, everything we can. So that was sort of the goal of the book once it got started.
And you had an interesting ride with this, because was it when we were talking over the phone not too long ago, and I was reading on your website, you know, putting this book together was a bit challenging, and
was
reading about how your manuscript got in the wrong hands. Do you want to talk
about that? Yeah. It took 7 years. So I worked on it for 7 years. I started sort of in late 1999, maybe 2000, and it came out in March 2007. I was actually at the hospital. My wife had just given birth to my second daughter, and when I got home, the email had come from Scott Teal from Crowbar Press. Hey, the book is out. So I remember the date pretty well. And yeah, it was pretty eye-opening coming from the fan perspective, where you think, you know, about storylines and about, you know, just the wrestling business in general. And you don't realize that behind the scenes, there's as much... well, let's just put it this way. It comes from, you know, wrestling, professional wrestling comes from, you know, the carny circuit. So there's a lot of that still in there. I mean, as you guys probably know, as much as me, if not more, there's a lot of sort of shysterism, I guess is what you could say, in the business. And it can, I think I heard Jim Cornette say recently, the wrestling business is full of crazy people and regular people, and the regular people are driven crazy by the crazy people, something like that. I don't know. I'm sorry, I totally rambled. What was the question again?
Just the whole process of putting the book together, and it came out coinciding with was it Larry Matisic and Barbara Gutis?
Yeah, that's kind of a sore spot. But so I had gotten Larry's name from Dave Meltzer. Dave said, you need to talk to Larry Matisic, because he and Brody were such good friends, you know, in the St. Louis area and sort of in the late 80s, mid to late 80s. So I got a hold of Larry. We did an amazing hour and a half interview. He gave me so much information. I mean, he's quoted all throughout my book.
Oh yeah.
And then we did a second, and he said that he was still in touch with Brody's widow, Barbara Goodish. And we did a second interview, you know, it was an hour long, and he said, oh, yeah, I'm trying to contact Barbara. And then the third time I talked to him, he was, like, kind of rude to me. Like, I'm saying like a lot, huh? That's a California thing.
It's fine, man.
Yeah,
we
say worse things over on the East Coast.
I'm from Brooklyn, so I speak Brooklynese, so it's...
Gotcha. You'll have stuff that I'm not familiar with. Right, okay.
Absolutely.
So I talked to Larry, and Larry said something to the effect of... Remember, guys, this was a long time ago.
It's quite all right.
Something to the effect of, Barbara doesn't want to talk to you. She has no interest in talking with you. So you need to just let that go. Yeah. And he had been so friendly with me before, so I thought, whoa, geez, okay, this is kind of weird. He had put me in contact with some other people, too, from the St. Louis area that I don't know that we're kind of how do I want to put this?
Any way you want. This is no.
Yeah, well, they had been friendly with Bruiser Brody. Let's put it this way.
Okay. Colleagues.
They had been women that had been extremely friendly with Bruiser Brody.
Gotcha.
And these were people that you know, Larry had put me in touch with. So I thought, oh, okay, you know, that's cool. And then, so I, for some reason, I got like this weird feeling that I had done something wrong or something had, I had blown something with Barbara Goodish, even though I had never met her, never talked to her. Really, I knew she was in Florida somewhere, and that was about it. So I thought, okay, I'll just drop it. I'll leave Larry alone. There's something going on. I don't understand what's going on. And then a couple months later, I was actually contacted by somebody from ECW Press, and they said, oh, hey, it sounds like you got this great project going on. I don't really want to say the person's name, but this great project going on, and you know, why don't you send me something? And I said, well, I'll send you the whole manuscript, everything I have. I mean, this is me being naive. That's totally my fault. I'll send you the whole thing, everything I have. But really, it's just a jumble of quotes right now. I haven't filled in anything. This is back when the project had about half as many interviews as it ended up with. You know, there's a lot of gaps. So I send it off. They send it back saying, hey, you know, this thing's just a jumble of quotes. We're not interested in it. It is just a jumble of quotes. And then a while after that, I got a call that this other book was coming out, that Larry Matisick and Barbara Goodish were coming out with a book through ECW Press. So, you know, I was heartbroken and you know, there was nothing I could do about it. I had given them my manuscript. So the best case scenario is they have the manuscript, and the manuscript is comprised of quotes from other people and history and investigation that I had done. So it's not, it wasn't, how do I want to say it? Like, I don't feel that I could copyright it because it's real history, you know, and that's at best. At worst, they could just rip it off directly and use the quotes themselves, which they didn't end up doing. So it was a real bitter pill, and it stung quite a bit. I was pretty broken by all that, but in the end, I think that their book tells a very different story than mine does. Mm. You know, it's from the perspective of his wife. I mean, who could know him better, and his best, and one of his best friends. So, I think most of what Larry says in that book you can find in my book, but I think it's an interesting book. Have you guys read that book?
No,
we haven't.
No,
it's actually pretty good.
I'm sure it is.
It sits pretty well on the shelf next to my book. I think that they cover
that's
just
cool.
about everything.
So you were a fan, and that's what inspired you to start digging. Well, you were a fan, so you wanted to do the movie first, the documentary, and then turn into a book.
Yeah, so Bruce Brody was one of my heroes when I was little, maybe like you guys too. And so I was working in the film industry and, you know, saving money, but I was doing mostly lighting, like I said, and camera. And I thought, God, you know, I really want to do something that's mine. I'm working on other people's, you know, projects. I want something that's mine. And I was up in my mother's attic going through a bunch of wrestling magazines. And there's, I forget, it's like Wrestling Ringside. It's got Paul Orndorff on the cover. And on the back, there's this picture of Bruiser Brody pointing at his face, just screaming in blood. And it was like I always tell people, the angels were like this light shone down, and the angels, oh, and I thought, oh shit, this is what I'm going to do. So I, it just popped like that. And, so I just started, trying to contact people, and Jimmy Snuka was the first one to come back, and Dory Funk quickly emailed me back. And, so that's sort of how it started.
Actually, before you called, me and Phil were trading our stories about how we, you know, our favorite Brody moments. So I guess to segue into, you know, getting into more like details about Brody, like what was your absolute favorite Brody moment? Because I know in the book you cover some of his matches, like the
oh yeah, some of his matches. Okay, so when I was a little kid, I knew Brody mostly from the magazines, but you could catch World Class on ESPN sometimes.
That's funny, because actually Phil was talking.
Say that again?
Actually, before you called, Phil was saying the exact same thing about that. That's right. How he got into Brody.
Yeah, we didn't get cable. I didn't get cable television on my block in New York City until late 89, early 1990. And ESPN would show reruns of World Class and AWA. So.
And they showed a huge, like, they weren't like little house shows. They were like the big show, you know, the big shows. So. Right. Yeah, there was a time I remember when I was young, we could watch WWF on like Saturday mornings, and then you could watch it on Monday evenings. I forgot what that show was called on USA. It was before Raw. And then you could watch Tuesday Night Titans, the freaking WWF talk show.
Right.
And then you could also get UWF, which was on like after the Morton Downey Jr. show or something. And you could get World Class, you could get AWA, and then Pedicino's show, which, you know, had a bunch of different
territories. That was global. That was
territories.
Global. Yeah,
in
the
it.
Global Wrestling Federation, yep.
Yeah, so it was like crazy. There was so much wrestling if you were patient.
If you dug for it, absolutely.
Okay, so my favorite Brody moment when I was a kid was the Steel Cage match with Abdullah the Butcher, which was shown on World Class Wrestling, and Fritz Von Erich is the special guest referee. So that to me was like the cream of the crop. I got it. I videotaped it. You know, I had it in SP format. You know, it was just beautiful. I watched it over and over. But as an adult, my favorite one has probably got to be his 2 out of 3 falls match with Ric Flair that goes to the 60-minute time limit draw.
Yeah.
That's just a beautiful, beautiful match. And, I mean, Ric Flair can pretty much have a beautiful match with anyone, but and there's something about how they left the house lights on for the first fall, where you can just see how huge that St. Louis arena is. I can't remember the name of the arena, but
that's the Kiel Auditorium, I believe.
The Kiel Auditorium, yeah. And so, that's got to be my favorite match.
And that was like one of those, you know, few occasions where Brody just kind of showed that he could hang. He wasn't just a brawler.
Right, right. So, yeah, so he didn't, he didn't gas out. He had the repertoire to, what was it? One old wrestler, I think it was Bob Roop, that said, oh, yeah, you know, you have to understand wrestling is like stand-up comedy. You need to have enough material to do those 60-minute matches. So whether you can physically hang or not, you need to have the material. So, yeah, and Brody could do that when it called for it.
Yeah, and there's also a quote in the book from Nick Bockwinkel. So, Brody always, had things his way, but if you forced him to wrestle, he would wrestle.
Yeah, and you can find those old tapes. I mean, well, DVDs or whatever. I'm sure there's torrents now, but where he's wrestling Nick, and he's some of his Japanese matches, and yeah, he that was one thing that was so great about him was. He could wrestle on whatever level he needed to. And a lot of people don't understand that. The thumping and the brawling, that was a style, that accomplished a goal. It told a story in the ring. And he could tell a different story if he needed to. Mm. It's like Hulk Hogan. If you watch Hulk Hogan's matches in Japan, he's like, throwing an armbar, and he has hammer locks.
We just covered one.
Over here, nobody wants to see that. You know, he punches someone, and everyone does a backflip. They're so happy.
Dave and I just talked about that a few weeks ago. That Hogan stuff in Japan is awesome.
It's actually really good stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, he was trained by Matsuda, right? So
yeah.
He has a background in something. Matsuda doesn't, not gonna let him walk out of there with being an idiot.
Exactly. And now, we all know Brody is a great performer, but also, he's been a controversial dude. And I think especially with this last month going down, WWE has guys like CM Punk that are just kind of, walking out on their contract. There's like sports figures doing the same. But, Brody was doing that before, everybody else was.
Right. He was one of those outlaws. I mean, there was a handful of them that when I mean, there was a lot of outlaws, right, in the 70s and the early 80s. You know, that was a way of life. People traveled through the territories. But once in 1983, when Vince McMahon started buying up all the top talent from each territory and sort of globalized everything, there were not as many of those people that could go from territory to territory. You know, Andre got sucked up, so he couldn't do that. Abdullah was one, and Stan Hansen to some degree was one. But Brody was sort of the king of the outlaws, traveling and making money, you know, go here for a little while, go here for a little while. And you guys, I'm sure, know his reputation with promoters. He pissed them off, and there's just as many stories in the book that go the other way. You know, he'd show up to a house show, and he had been promised one thing, and a promoter didn't deliver. The AWA, Vern Gagne, used to advertise him for shows that they knew he wasn't going to be on. So it sort of went both ways, and he was just looking out for himself and to provide for his family. So,
yeah, which is great, and because before you came on, we were talking about the style of the book, and it's, you know, told in so many, you know, different voices, like especially concerning you know, his relationships with promoters, like for instance, was I remember you know, Gary Hart's, you know, one of the few guys that he was cool with.
Yeah.
He was putting him over, saying, like, hey, you know, he always kept his word, always did what, you know, he was told. And if he said he was going to be there, he'd be there. But then, like, the next quote, somebody yeah, saying he was bullshit. He didn't show up or.
Yeah, it was like Bob Geigel or Harley Race, probably. Or, yeah. He never messed with Sam Muchnick, you know, who was the head of the NWA for so long and so well respected. Never messed with him. Certainly never really messed with Fritz Von Erich. You know, he even took the book for a while from Fritz. He was always pretty straight with Baba. You know, he jumped for a short time to New Japan and had that series of matches with Inoki, and then, you know, had to really come back on his knees to get back in with Baba, but he did. Dory Funk was the booker at that time and helped him with that. It went back and forth. You know, there were always rumors that he and Stan Hansen said they were going to screw over every promoter in the world or in the country or whatever, but he did what he had to do, and I think sometimes the fans did have to suffer, you know, the long headlock matches, or, you know, the yeah. Lex Luger match in the steel cage in Florida, I never bashed him. I always felt like, you know, he did what he had to do.
You know, now putting this book together, like how has your opinion of Brody, like, changed since, you know, being a kid watching him?
Well, a couple of things happened, you know, along the way. You know, I got married and became a dad myself, so I think I ended up sympathizing more with him. One thing you mentioned earlier was Gary Hart. I had no idea what a big part of Brody's life Gary Hart was. I had no idea.
Because he was handling all his bookings and everything.
Yeah, he took care of his bookings for a long time there.
It was like 10 years.
And he worked out of Gary Hart's office. And Gary, you know, provided him with the previous year's NWA contact booklet. And they were, like, really tight with each other. Also, the way Brody handled himself in business, I think it sounds sort of cheesy, but that influenced me. Yeah, I think that's it.
You know, it's in the book, it's so well put. Like Dave was mentioning before, like, you know, you say one positive thing about him and then follow up with a negative.
Yeah.
What was your impression of him after the book came out? Like, after you got the book put out, and now you're a dad, and
yeah,
you're not watching wrestling like you used to, unless you're a hardcore fan like I am, and I'm pushing 40 now. But
yeah.
But what was your impression of him after the book was out?
After the book came out, when I watched him, it's sort of weird, but I look at his face and I look at, whoa, there's my dog. Everything that he's thinking about. And that sort of affects, I watched that in the matches where I never did before. He had a personality when he was younger that was sort of the, you know, pulling pranks and being crazy and wild. And when he got older, I don't know what it was exactly, but he got a lot more serious. And you can sort of see that in his early matches versus his later matches, sort of the change in him. And I sort of look at him a lot more like a person because does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. It makes perfect sense because we were just talking about before we were talking about the I don't know if you follow the current product at all, but the WWE is putting out a network.
Yeah.
And a lot of guys on our Facebook page were asking if they're going to put like guys like Chris Benoit on a page. And,
oh, yeah.
Right. And
well, I already saw, you know, just on their website, I did see some Brody matches.
Right. Well, the thing
is, I mean, they're, you know,
no,
1 minute of a Brody match. But
yeah, no, they are. But the point was, like Dave and I were talking about, some wrestling fans can't differentiate the character from the person right. when they find out stuff yeah. about their real life. You know?
Oh, right, right,
so
right.
Which intertwines with my question to you was, you know, what was your take on him? And more
he was, yeah, okay, so let me finish that a little bit then. Okay, yeah, he was much more calculating than he was the crazy madman. And that's what I can see more. I can see, you know, him thinking and, you know, it's sort of that old thing where, say, Abdullah the Butcher, the more he and Abdullah were crazy and beat the shit out of each other and were wild and slamming each other, the more asses they put in seats and the more money they made. So this craziness and this insanity was all with a purpose, and it was all calculated. And I just – oh, it's just aces, you know.
Yeah, because actually there's a I don't want to say a shoot interview because there weren't, like, shoot interviews at this time. He was still keeping kayfabe, but he's – it's like this like half hour shoot interview esque
yeah.
kind of thing on YouTube, and you know, he's not, you know, in character or anything like that, but he seemed like
he's mellow, yeah,
a very
he's still telling stories though,
yeah,
even in that he's telling stories. You know, I forgot who he said. I think it's in that video. No, maybe I got it from somewhere else. I forgot who he said brought him into the wrestling business. He used to always say this guy's name. It was a football player from Detroit. Walter Johnson? No, I can't remember, but it's been so long. But he kept telling that story, and I went back and I interviewed all the football players. I interviewed all the early wrestlers, the guys that trained them, and it wasn't this guy. So there's, you know, these guys, like I say in the introduction of the book, you know, they're traveling the world and they're living these you know, these cult-like celebrity lives. And the tall tales just get bigger and bigger and bigger. And sometimes, you know, reality disappears. And that was one of the big challenges of the book in the beginning, where I was like, you know, I'm going to take the Dave Meltzer route and try to find only the exact truth. Well, it became almost impossible, like you guys mentioned before, when you see, you know, five guys saying this and then five guys saying the exact opposite thing. It's like the truth sort of dissolves and crumbles underneath the legend and the myth.
Yeah.
So I sort of took the rule of, you know, if I heard it from two people or more, then it goes in the book. If, you know, if it's just one guy talking, you know, and there's a few in there, Ox Baker saying that he, you know, he got the part of, you know, his cameo role in, what was it? Escape from New York. Because Brody died, you know, Brody was the first choice, but he died. Well, you know, Escape from New York was shot in 1985, 1986.
Right.
Brody
yeah,
didn't die until 88. So,
right.
You know, that story had to go in because it's kind of an interesting story. But for the most part, I tried to really stick to, you know, hey, can I get this corroborated from a handful of people?
Yeah. Yeah. It's easier to call people out on stuff now because of the,
yeah,
you know,
for sure.
Because of the internet and stuff like that. So,
right, everybody's talking about the Ric Flair thing right now. So he did that shoot interview, and he's talking about Brody's death in 1986, which it actually was in 1988,
right.
And how he was there, and you know, all the records indicate he was actually up in the States wrestling that night.
And,
so it's you know.
That's what was so great about the book, because now as podcasters, we listen to other podcasts, and last year around right before Dave jumped on with me, I had listened to a Dutch Mantel interview on, I believe it was Colt Cabana's podcast. And, you know, very intriguing guy, still in the business, you know, and he's done a lot. He's been a promoter. He's been a manager. He's been a wrestler. He's done almost everything in the game. And he had a connection to this whole thing. But every single time he said something about the incident, which we'll lead up to in a few minutes, it was like it wasn't the same thing.
Yeah,
and it baffled me. So when I read the book last month with Dave, it was like I immediately called Dave. I was like, dude, this is what I was talking about.
Yeah. Okay. Hold on. Let me stop you for one sec. Yeah. Specifically with Dutch Mantel, you know, I did go on to a message board. He came on and I asked him about it. And he just shot me down. You know, he was like, that is incredibly rude of you to ask or something like that. And I, okay, sorry, sir. But I had an audio tape interview with him on an airplane where he goes over the incident. So I knew that was him, and so I used that. But he also has an account of the incident that is online that he wrote, I guess, and which is a totally different story. And then I'm basically reiterating what you just said, but and then I've heard, you know, him interviewed on YouTube videos, totally different stories. So, you know, Ric Flair is not there and saying he's there, and Dutch Mantel, who was there, is suddenly out catching a breath of fresh air when the event happened, and it's like you just have to stick.
I thought it was hilarious.
You put it in there, and other people will say, well. Agree with him, and other people will disagree with his version of things. And then, you know, that's what it is. So
I thought it was hilarious that Flair said not only that he was there, but when he heard the news, he was just sitting in the locker room waiting for his match.
That's great, isn't it? I just don't even understand it. I mean, I get it. Like, so I'm on the spot right now. I feel like I am, you know, doing an interview with you guys, and I might say something kind of weird or something might slip out. I mean, oh, I wish I wouldn't have said that. But that is such a huge thing.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, that is just, I don't even want to pretend to say what was going through his head. I have no idea. It was interesting.
Yeah, that's like such a strange thing for him to say. Like even him saying that he was there when he wasn't there, but saying that you know he played it safe and just stayed in the locker room and didn't bother with it. That's even crazier.
That is crazy. Yeah.
One of our listeners, and I guess this goes in line with what we're talking about right now. Baza Smith asked, wanted us to ask you about Tony Atlas regarding Bruiser Brody's death, and in particular regarding his refusal to offer testimony. And that's another thing. I heard him say something different, that he was never contacted to.
His story was always, you know, from the day, from the event, was that they didn't contact him until too late. And Dutch Mantel said the same thing. I think Tony Atlas was scared to go down there and or to go back. And I don't know. I had a couple interviews with Tony, and each time I talked to him, he said, I don't want to talk about that. And then we'd end up talking for 2 hours. But and he would tell me that he was afraid to go back. But then later he told me that he did go back and that he was in the same room with Jose Gonzalez. And so I don't know why he didn't go back or what was going through his head. And I don't want to sort of make that conjecture.
Yeah.
But
plus it seemed like a lot of guys were, you know, once that happened, they were just kind of turned off to the experience. But then there were guys that were still going, like,
you know,
Abdullah the Butcher.
Yeah, they're just like, I'm done. I'm not going back. Abdullah went back. He was friends with Carlos Colon for years and years. Dutch Mantel went back and ended up booking. I don't think he ever worked in the same company with Jose Gonzalez again. but you know, certainly he made a fine career down there. So
yeah, and well, a lot of actually a few of our listeners were asking, you know, what was like the general consensus about like how people thought about the death, from his, you know, fellow coworkers to his family and just friends and all that kind of stuff. Do you want to
about the why of the death, you think?
I guess like
this is from one of your listeners.
Yeah, I guess like a little bit about the why, as well as you know, just the general reaction of after.
I think the reaction was mostly shock. I think people sort of drop their petty differences when something like that happens.
Yeah.
The why is, in my opinion, you know, it started back in 1976 when they were both wrestling for the WWWF, and Brody, you know, came in, and here was Gonzalez, you know, fresh-faced, you know, baby face, and you know, making his way. Brody came in and sort of just kicked ass over everybody. There was one incident in the Nassau Coliseum where he beat the shit out of Jose Gonzalez. The story has it that his lip was hanging off his face.
Yeah, that story was actually talked about a lot as mm-hmm. a kid growing up in the 80s. And
oh, interesting. Uh-huh.
After he, but I didn't get it, though, till after he passed.
That's what I was going to ask. So was the story told? The story was not told before he passed?
No, because the legacy got huge after he passed. And this is, again, this is me being 12, 13 years old, not having the internet, not having a dirt sheet. It was just, at this point, pen pal, tape trading, no cable TV, and just wrestling magazines.
Yeah. So that was an incident that I've heard over and over. Then there's other incidents that are thrown out, you know, whether Jose Gonzalez's young daughter drowned in a puddle or something, or had been electrocuted. I had heard that his brother had just been killed. So he was undergoing a lot of stress right before. You know, which of those is true, I'm not exactly certain. But and then that he was the number two babyface in the WWC and Cologne's organization. He had always been. He bled for Cologne. He, you know, he looked up to him, and he idolized Cologne almost. And here comes Brody from the States, this guy that he had had trouble with earlier and kicked his ass and, you know, maybe he took his spot, I don't know. But here comes Brody, and he most certainly took a lot of, you know, he came in as a heel, wrestled as a heel, and then he made the switch to babyface, and boom, all of this glory goes away from Invader. And Invader also was given the book, and he, I don't know if he was, he was the booker. And God, so much of this is slipping out of my head over the years. He was the booker, and he would come up with story ideas and finishes to matches, and Brody would just ignore him. And Brody would put him down, from what I've heard, at every turn. And nobody took him very seriously, and I think he just got really fed up with that, whatever other personal issues were going on in his life, I'm not sure. And that's what happened. That's what I think is the reason why. Now, there's other stories that, you know, that they were in there operating on him. Oh, it's a simple knife wound, and suddenly the doctors were all dismissed, and Brody was left in a room by himself. I've never found big conspiracy, you know, I haven't been able to corroborate that stuff. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but I was never able to corroborate those stories. We did have one incident where we were trying to contact the courts down there, and down in the basement, I guess, is where they have all the records. And my wife and I spent 2 days she speaks Spanish, and we're trying to call them to get the records. We kept getting shifted around. We actually have a piece of paper with all the craziness, and we're getting shifted over here and sent over here, call over here. We finally get a lady down in the records in the basement, and we're saying, we're looking for these court records, and we tell her the case and all this stuff. And she says, oh, I'll go pull the case file. And we say, okay, great. She said, call me back later this afternoon or something. So we hang up, we call her back, and she's whispering, and she says, the case file is supposed to be there, but it's not. Don't ever call here again, and hangs up. And we're like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
Just a, you know, just like the cherry on the sundae of the Bruiser Brody thing. Like, what the fuck? So, no. I don't know. You know, people. I'm not big on conspiracies, but I don't know.
Do you know if like Carlos Colon or you know WWC had any political
connections? I've heard from many people. You know, he runs that island. You know, he has shills that know where you are at all times.
I want to just, yeah.
You're not going to get off the island unless it's okay with him. And stuff like that. You know?
I want to touch on Carlos Colon real quick.
Yeah.
The more in depth we got into the book, like towards the end, right after his death and before his death, I think you just hit the nail on the head in terms of Carlos politically, you know, flexing his muscle in terms of covering this all up. Do you think he had a hand in the events leading up to the incident? Like, do you think he knew the invader was mad at him and stuff like that?
I think he was mad at him. It would be hard for me to believe that he knew he was planning to kill him. There were other rumors I heard where Brody had bought part of the company and they were going to cut him out. But Brody was bringing in so much money for them, and I mean, what do you think? You think you're gonna kill this guy in a shower, and your business isn't gonna drop? The other American wrestlers are gonna be like, "Oh, that man, that sucks." Yeah, we always kind of didn't like Brody. He was always fighting, and you know, I mean, fuck that. That would be crazy. Yeah. So not to call you crazy or anything, because I have heard that many times. I don't think that that Colon knew the extent or knew what was going to happen. But I do think that Colon, you know, made things better for himself and Invader after it happened. You know, I think that he flexed his muscle.
I mean, let's be honest. I mean, Brody's death impacted both Puerto Rico and Japan, like, drastically.
Yeah.
Because of the booking and because of his presence. I mean, Japan, Dave was mentioning a few weeks ago, they, like, mourned, like, it was, like, a big deal over there.
Oh, it was huge. Yeah, so, it was absolutely huge.
You know, and then wrestlers stopped coming to Puerto Rico. I mean, you mentioned the, you know, Tony Atlas's and Dutch Mantel's of the world, but a lot of the American wrestlers didn't go to Puerto Rico for a long, long time after that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, those guys were the exceptions. You think about all the other wrestlers, you know, those great, and you can still get all the bootlegs or, you know, some of them are officially released, those great 80s, matches, that territory was hot, and they had a lot of American wrestlers going down there, and you know, I would, you know, almost all of them just stopped. You know, it killed their business. It just killed their business.
All right. Well, here's speaking of people that were in the book. Who were the most? I know you mentioned on the webpage, but who were the most difficult people to talk to? Like, what was it? How hard was, like, when every time you spoke to them, it was like, oh, like, you know, like,
yeah,
how, like, honestly, like, who were the hardest people to talk to?
The hardest people for me to call, that's kind of hard. Bill Watts would have been one.
Not surprised.
He just did, you know, he didn't hold back. He did not like Brody.
Yeah, he has some
and
of my favorite quotes.
In one time I called him when there was a football game on, and he started cussing at me. So that was kind of sucked. I'm sitting here with friends, and you want me to talk about that asshole? Something like that. Harley Race was tough for me to talk to because I talked to him in person, and he just did not say much, you know, and I don't think he had a lot of great feelings about Brody, and he didn't know who the hell I was. You know, I was just a nobody. Snuka was really hard because, well, he's Jimmy Snuka, and
we know that.
It's just he doesn't remember a lot.
Yeah, we know that too.
What's that?
We know that too.
Yeah.
And he talks in like code words, and then he gives you a hug, and then you know he gives you the sign, you know, the "I love you" sign, and then. It's just really weird talking to him. Lord James Blears didn't remember who Brody was. That was heartbreaking.
Wow.
Vern Gagne, he was not in any position to be interviewed, so I didn't get to. Okay, who was tough, though? God,
what about Bockwinkel? I loved Bockwinkel.
Oh,
stuff
my
in the
God.
Book.
No, Bockwinkel was awesome. God, he was so great.
Well, I honestly, between the structure of the book, which was fantastic, and Nick Bockwinkel put it so over the top for me. For some reason, his stuff stood out more.
Like, that's great. And that's all on video. I have the video of that. That was a video interview. He is such
that.
A gentleman. The guy is so well-spoken. He's so intelligent. And I just felt like before our interview, he had really thought about it. And I don't know if you guys have this experience interviewing wrestlers or when you talk to them. A lot of them don't remember your name or take the time to remember your name.
No, at least for me.
You know, I was just a little, you know, fanboy. But he, like, remembered my name. And he was just so sharp. Ivan Putski was really hard for me to get a hold of.
That was another thing. We didn't know Putski's connection. Like, that's amazing. Like, in New York.
You didn't know the Putski connection. Yeah.
No, that was the thing. Like, Putski was the man up here in New York when I was
right. Oh, Polish Power, right, for sure.
Dude, he was like the mid-card, like, champion. Like,
yeah, right. He was like the first Ultimate Warrior or whatever, you know.
Exactly.
Just huge.
So we didn't know the connection, and I was amazed by
Putski. Was a high school PE teacher who had his wife had too many kids, too many girls, and he could not he couldn't live on that salary, so he got into wrestling. Yeah. I love that story. And he knew a lot of those Toros, a lot of those football players down there from the Continental Football League, and he worked out with Bruiser Brody, and I kept trying to get him to come into the ring. He was the one. He was the one that brought him in.
And what was it? I was reading.
He was. I called him, the poor man. I used to have Mondays off of work, and so that was my Bruiser Brody day. I called him and Harley Race, these poor guys. I called him every Monday for about 5 years.
I was just about to get to that.
And left a message. And I always pretended like I had never called before. Hi, this is Emerson Murray. I'm writing a book on Bruiser Brody. And I was wondering if you could get in touch. Finally, one day, after years, Ivan Putski answered the phone.
Wow.
So it was like, what? Well, the other funny one was getting a hold of Carlos Colon.
Oh, boy.
Somebody down there had given me the number for WWC or whatever their company is. And I called that number every Monday because he was one of the last ones. So every Monday for 7 years, and the phone just rang and rang and rang and rang. And, I was talking to somebody else who's a photographer down there. And I said, yeah, I've been calling this number and, it just rings. I don't know who, you know, I don't know what's going on. Is it some front or something? You know, my mind goes crazy thinking about all the shady stuff. And, he gives me the number, and I've been calling one digit off for 7 years.
Wow.
I don't know what the hell number I was calling. But so the first time I call it, I get some tough guy. What do you want? And then I say, I want to talk to Carlos Colon. And my timing was also perfect because they were doing that Bruiser Brody Memorial Cup, which is, I thought, rather disgusting. But so Colon was actually willing to talk to me. What's that?
That's the one at Sabu one, right?
Yeah, that's the Sabu one. It was like a double ring battle royal.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that. I never saw it.
And then they held it in the arena that he died in.
Yeah, I heard about that.
It's eerie. It's like everything wrong with the wrestling business, you know?
Yeah.
But he was willing to talk to me. And I don't remember if he laid down any rules or anything, but we just jumped into it. And he was serious but upbeat, and you know, I told him, I said, this is first person. I want to hear what you say. I'm not going to twist it around. Also, Invader used to have a website, and he may still. I haven't looked, and you couldn't Google it, which was really weird. And I don't remember how I got it, but I got a bunch of pictures off there, and I emailed him constantly saying, you know, even if it's just written, I don't care. I just want your side of the story. I don't, you know, I'm not going to put my own words in there. Not going to put any words in your mouth. I just want to hear what you have to say. Cause I had heard people have ran into him drunk, and he, you know, kind of like you were talking about earlier, he just had different story each time and everything. So those are some of my hits and misses.
Now, what about getting Stan Hansen to do the foreword for the...
Stan Hansen, I've still never met. I never talked to him.
Wow.
That was all Scott Teal. Scott Teal ended up being good buddies with him, and Crowbar has actually released Stan Hansen's biography. Or autobiography, excuse me. And, Scott Teal arranged all that. Mm. Yeah, Scott was pretty amazing. You know, after ECW Press screwed me over, I was really thinking about self-publishing because I had a lot of ideas for the book on how it was going to look, and that I wanted color pages, but I didn't want like one little color section in the middle of the book, and I wanted to design it myself, and you know, tons of pictures, square bound, you know, square shaped, and I really didn't want anything on the cover except for a picture of Bruiser Brody. But because I thought, well, it's going to be, you know, I'm going to be selling it online. So no matter where the picture is, it's going right next to it is going to be the words Bruiser Brody, you know, click here, no matter where it is. So, Scott Teal from Crowbar Press got in touch with me, and I said, I want this, 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 and this. And he said, okay. And he was amazing in getting the book published, and he had a ton. If you look at the credits at the beginning, he helped out with a ton of interviews. He really added a lot to the book.
Yeah, and he seemed like he was able to get a lot of guys for you that they were just kind of passing you up and all that kind of stuff.
And the cover photo is from Scott Romer, who is a photographer, and I picked that because I thought it's a black and white photo that I turned, you know, sort of sepia tone. I thought, it's just a perfect Brody picture. He's covered in blood, but it's black and white, you know, so my mom's not going to puke.
Right.
And he's by himself. He's, you know, sitting there looking thoughtful by himself, covered in blood. It was just like, it showed both sides of him so perfectly, I thought.
Mm. Now, I guess we've had you on for like almost an hour, so we're going to...
Oh, sorry.
No, we're not sorry.
We can keep going if you want.
We don't want to keep you. We just, there's so many things. I mean, it's such a fascinating story, and he's such a great... He was such a great performer that,
This interview can be 24 hours, and we won't stretch.
Exactly.
Right, right.
But before we get into the death, I want to just ask you about his wife, Barbara, and how was the interactions with her prior to the whole other book thing? And
it wasn't. I've never talked to her before.
So that was all Scott then?
Mm.
No, she's not in the book. The wife that is interviewed in the book is a woman named Marie Neese.
Oh, Marie, I'm sorry, not Barbara. Yeah, I'm sorry. I meant to say
Yeah, that's
Marie.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, how did I get in touch with her? Maybe through classmates.com? No, I can't remember, but... Oh, no. You know, I found a... it was published online. It was like the divorces in every divorce in Texas.
Wow.
And I found her name because I had heard her name from a bunch of the football players. All the football players just loved her. And they just all spoke so highly of her. And so I gave it a shot and then searched for her name online. And found her, and we communicated through email. So her parts were written by her, and they weren't spoken. And it just put such a. It was so refreshing to have a female perspective, especially of somebody that was that close to him. You know, that was amazing. That was to me. That's some of my favorite stuff in the book when she talks about him and how funny he is.
Yeah.
And how funny he was and crazy, you know, just the, she made him a peanut, this is so stupid, but she made him a peanut butter and banana sandwich. And then she asked him, oh, how'd you like it? And he said, oh, I took it out and threw it on the ground and stepped and smashed it with my foot. I don't know. It's just like, it's just perfect Bruiser Brody kind of stuff, but wrapped in this, you know, unique perspective.
Yeah, because it seemed like everybody had like their own. Well, obviously they had their own take on him, but you know they would have like drastic ones. Like some people, like for me in particular, I remember Hansen's. I guess they were in the same territory for the first time, and they're like, it's like we got Frank Goodish here, and he's like him, and then he's like going off all these wild stories from when they were.
Yeah, he's like that crazy guy, and Brody's like trying to be quiet. No, shut up, man! I'm trying to be respectable here. Oh, so funny. And then Eddie Greiz, all his stories, you know, they were smoking buddies. They smoked dope together. And that was a totally different, like, what perspective. And then all the Japanese, you know, the Funks, Terry Funk, you know, had the college stories plus the Japanese story, you know, the stories from Japan. Yeah, it really is like a, so many, different perspectives of him.
So
also interesting how many people that were like, oh, he was so great. You know, we were best buds. And
then
yeah,
like the absolute opposite.
Yeah.
Like the destroyer
yeah, exactly.
quote.
So I think because he was so straight that, you know, if he showed people a little attention, they just loved him.
Mm. All right, so it's been a couple of years since the book's been out. And
yeah.
I mean, what was the response you got from like insiders? You know, like the Meltzers of the world, and I mean, the you know.
Well, it got, you know, from Dave Meltzer. I don't know. I don't know that he ever even wrote about it. But and he's a big part of it. His interview was amazing. The dude's mind is like a steel trap. He just remembers things so well. I had a lot of really positive feedback. I was worried about, you know, I had published the coroner's report after he passed away.
Yeah,
even that on my website, I had BruiserBrody.com. I had asked, do you think it's appropriate? And overwhelmingly, everyone said, yes, we want, you know, and we want to see it. So I did put it in the book. I thought that would be too much, a little too callous, but I guess it wasn't. I got all good response from that. And, I haven't actually got a lot of sort of insider response. A lot of the message boards, I was surprised at how a handful of fans thought the book was very negative towards Bruiser Brody. It was a contingent that seemed to be sort of from St. Louis. This is before Mattisick's book came out, but from St. Louis, and they thought the book was really negative, which sort of surprised me, but... You know, when you're telling a full picture of somebody, it's hard not to be in certain points.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, obviously this book is from 2007, and we're still talking mm-hmm. about it now. Like, what do you feel, you know, keeps the legacy of Bruiser Brody alive even to the point now? And, you know, we sent you a bunch of the questions some of the listeners
are yeah.
sending. And it's
well, one thing that pisses me off is the misinformation. The misinformation that is constantly out there on... You know, whether it's Wikipedia or message boards or some of the questions that people send in, it's like the truth is there. You know, you can pick it up and you can read it, but the misinformation just keeps it alive. And I think almost it makes me angry, but at the same time, it's almost beneficial because it's those tall tales and that mythology that keeps it interesting and keeps it crazy. And then you can go and say, oh, well, it's everyone's telling me these, you know, absolutely crazy stories. You go and look at it and say, yeah, it is crazy, but you know, it was a dude, doing what he had to do to feed his family. And, the core of it is not all that crazy.
No. All right. So let's get into, what are you doing now? Are you doing anything now or,
No, you know, I started compiling an Andre the Giant book before their biography came out. I thought, gosh, this would be – every person that I talk to has an – you know, in the industry and even fans has an Andre the Giant story. So I thought, God, this format, this sort of first person or primary source biography would really lend itself to Andre the Giant because he's another larger-than-life kind of icon. And so I started working on that, and then they came out with their own biography, which is kind of watered down, and it doesn't go into some of the great stories. But I always thought that would be a lot of fun. So I have not a lot of work on it, but I have some work done. Yeah, I went back and did more film and video work, and, you know, painting was my first love, so I do a lot of that now.
So one last question before we send you off. We had some fans asking, you know, how did, you know, did Bruiser Brody affect, you know, the careers of like Mick Foley and the Berserker
and all that kind of stuff.
So who's the Berserker? I don't know the Berserker. That's not John Nord, is it?
It is John Nord.
Oh, it is John Nord. Okay. Well, John, that character was clearly just a ripoff of Bruiser Brody. So